yesterday, they just simply went into what was already scheduled, what was already planned, which, one, I will say, many of us think that it's almost as if, like, we've seen this many times over history in Katrina, for example, in New Orleans, where politicians said, let the hurricane do for New Orleans what we couldn't do. This was the same thing that was echoing for us as we watched these counter protesters so violently attack our students, is though we'll just sit back and let that happen instead. And the irony of these counter protesters attacking these vulnerable students, who are also incredibly strong and brave and organized in an enclosed space, the analogy that we can make to what's happening in Gaza is obviously lost on all of these counter protesters. They have no regard for the lives, just as the UCLA administration. People could have died the night before last and this night as well. And these are the conditions under which students are trying to enact free speech.
Well, Gay Teresa Johnson, we want to thank you for being with us, UCLA Professor of African American Studies and Chicano Studies. We also want to thank Mel Buer of the Real News Network and Shanth Kodialam Nangunari. Shanth is one of four reporters, a senior reporter with the Daily Bruin, the UCLA paper, who was attacked by the counter protesters. Coming up, we'll speak to the former president of Brandeis University, founded by the American Jewish community in the wake of the Holocaust. What he says about today's student protests may surprise you. Back in 20 seconds.
You're getting, knowing what I'm knowing, while the black band's sweating in the rhythm I'm rolling. Gotta give us what we want, gotta give us what we need.
Hey.
Our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power.
Fight the power, public enemy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
As we continue to look at the widening police crackdown on pro-Palestinian student protests, we're joined now in Washington, D.C. by Frederick Lawrence, the former president of Brandeis University, which was founded in 1948 by the American Jewish community in the wake of the Holocaust. Frederick Lawrence is also the former dean of the George Washington University Law School and a former visiting professor and senior research scholar at Yale Law School.
Frederick Lawrence, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. You just heard our first segment, what's happening right now. Police raiding UCLA campus, dismantling the Gaza encampment and arresting students. You heard about the counter-protesters attacking the journalists and those in the encampment. And then, of course, we just came out of the police doing the very same thing at Columbia University, dismantling the encampment and going into Hamilton Hall that the students had occupied. Can you respond to what's happening right now and what you think should be the path and the response of universities around this country as students rise up in horror about what's happening in Gaza?
I think when students rise up on any issues around the world or on their local communities as well, universities have to begin with first principles. We exist for the purposes of creating and discovering knowledge. That requires free expression and protection for free expression. We talk about balancing free expression on the one hand, safety on the other. And although I understand that, it somewhat misses the point, which is to say safety is essential for campuses, but safety is instrumental to protect the fundamental goal, and that's free expression. So in a case like what happened at UCLA, there's an interesting example there of sometimes universities can do too much, but sometimes they can do too little. And clearly one of the things that came across was the need for intervention sooner to protect the violence that was going on at UCLA. But I think I would even take the camera back a long way further and say that the real answer here is work that takes place a long time before these events happen. You have to build relationships on campus. You have to know who these student leaders are and student groups are so that the kinds of conflicts that we're seeing now don't happen the way that they're being presented, but happen in a much more productive way for all concerned.
And could you explain whether protocols, what are the ordinary conventional protocols in place at universities dealing with protests, and whether those have changed in the last month since we've seen the Gaza protests begin?
I think different universities obviously approach this different ways, but if you look at the ones that are the most productive, the most functional right now, they really cover a range of outcomes and a range of approaches. Look at University of Chicago, where the president just put out a statement that said, here are the rules of engagement, and that you can stay out on the quad and in camp for certain lengths of time, but here are the guard rules, anti-harassment rules still apply, you can't threaten people, you can't interrupt the functioning of the university, but you can have an encampment. President of Williams College put out a statement roughly along the same lines. President of Brown was involved in negotiations with students where I think they reached what appears to be a pretty good result. Did the students get everything they wanted? Of course not. And did the university get everything they wanted? Of course not. You know, one of the biggest mistakes here is when you start to think about the students as they, as opposed to we. There's only one constituency here, and that's the university. The faculty, the students, the staff, the administration, the trustees, all have to think of themselves as we, working together. As soon as it splinters into they, that's when you start getting problems and sometimes tragedies.
And what about your response, Professor Lawrence, to what the university professors say, namely, the university administration administration say across the board, which is that they're acting in the interests of students, Jewish students on campus, who feel they're being threatened on campus. As the crackdown on the student uprising has intensified, the House now has passed a bill to widen the federal definition of anti-Semitism. Critics of the bill included Jerry Nadler, the most senior Jewish member of Congress and a strong supporter of Israel. Nadler said, quote, this bill threatens to chill constitutionally protected speech. Speech that is critical of Israel alone does not constitute discrimination. The bill sweeps too broadly, Nadler said. Meanwhile, Republican lawmakers are vowing to launch new investigations into elite universities. Earlier this week, House Republican Whip Tom Emmer claimed, quote, pro-terrorist anti-Semites taking over our college campuses. So if you could respond to that, what you think is actually going on and how the Biden administration is responding, what's happened in the House?
The most important thing is to focus on the limits on expression, which are pretty far out on the horizon. Free expression, free inquiry, academic freedom all have to be given broad range for protection. Where there's actual threatening behavior, that can be restricted, that can be precluded. So when you hear about talk of actual threatening behavior, I think there is a reason for the university to clamp down. But provoking people, challenging people, asking difficult questions, making people uncomfortable, that's part of the price of living in a democracy, if you will. That's what it means to live in a self-governing society. Interrupting the actual functioning of the university, that can be precluded. You can't block off buildings. You can't keep students from getting into a library or into a classroom. But you can certainly create a encampment that might make it less comfortable for some students to get to class. Again, discomfort is not something that you should avoid in all cases in a university. Safety certainly should be provided. So I think that's the balance that universities have to strike. And on some campuses, they have to do a better job of striking that balance.
And this is particularly interesting coming from you, Frederick Lawrence. If you can talk about the history of the founding of Brandeis University and also your concern. I mean, it's the issue you're talking about right now. When Jewish students say they're made to feel uncomfortable, and so you have the House acting and calling you'll even have the networks when they say they feel threatened, just showing a Palestinian flag or a person wearing a keffiyeh, what that means.
We have been far too loose with what we mean by threatened, and not just in the past few months, but in the past few years. Many people feel that when they hear views that they deeply disagree with, that's threatening to them. That's not how universities operate. You are not entitled to be intellectually safe. You are entitled to be physically safe. So where there are actual threats,
certainly people are entitled to be protected. Hopefully by university procedures and by university security only as a last resort with public officials and with police in riot gear. Hopefully that's always a last resort. But anything short of that, which is to say that which challenges one's ideas on any of the sides of these issues, that has to be part of an open conversation. Of course, these are difficult conversations. Of course, these issues are fraught. Look, let me give you an example of one that worked recently that I was involved in. I was what was called a free expression resident at Skidmore College, upstate New York, for several days. Met with a number of groups, but in particular had about an hour with a group of Jewish students and a group of Muslim students talking about Israel-Palestine, talking about what was going on in Gaza. It was not an easy conversation. It was a hard conversation. But at the same time, we made some progress. I heard from the president of the college last night that he has continued to meet with these students, and he feels as if, in his words, it's an era of cooperation, not antagonism. That's the model that we're looking for that I think we should see on more campuses.
And the point of the founding of Brandeis University, why your voice is particularly important right now.
It's Brandeis University named for Justice Louis Brandeis. Justice Louis Brandeis, who famously said, in the absence of incitement of lawless activity, of imminent lawless activity, the answer to speech you disagree with is more speech, not enforced silence. And Brandeis would have said that on any side of any issue. You cannot permit incitement of imminent lawless activity, but you have to protect the ability to express a wide range of views. Brandeis University has always been dedicated to that. That's one of the reasons that, as its president, I was proud to advocate for free expression on a wide level. At the same time, the limits come, as I say, where safety is involved or where the orderly operation of the university is involved. Those things have to be protected.
Frederick Lawrence, I want to thank you for being with us, former president of Brandeis University, also former dean of the George Washington University Law School, and former visiting professor and senior research scholar at Yale Law School. He's currently the CEO of the Phi Beta Kappa Society and distinguished lecturer at Georgetown Law School. Next up, Amnesty International is calling on the Biden administration to immediately halt arms sales to Israel. We'll go to Jerusalem back in 20 seconds.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Look how I'm living now. Police be tripping now. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area. I got the strap. I gotta carry 'em. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go into this. Yeah, yeah, this is gorilla. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go get the bag. Yeah, yeah, or I'ma get the pad. Yeah, yeah, I'm so cold like, yeah.
This is America by Childish Gambino. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
A coalition of international NGOs are holding a global day of action today, calling on all states to halt the transfer of weapons, parts and ammunition to Israel as the death toll in Gaza tops 34,500.
We go now to Jerusalem, where we're joined by Budur Hassan, a Palestinian writer and Amnesty International researcher on Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, contributing researcher to a new Amnesty report titled U.S.-made weapons used by government of Israel in violation of international law and U.S. law. Budur, thank you so much for being with us. Why don't you tell us the conclusions of the Amnesty International report?
The USA, in response to the National Security Memorandum on accountability and safeguards on the transfer of defense items and other services to Israel, is based on first-hand documentation by Amnesty International of how U.S.-made weapons and U.S.-supplied weapons have been used by Israel in unlawful attacks, not just during the current war, but also in an earlier military campaign in May, where they were used in disproportionate attacks, killing civilians and injuring civilians, and where they were used where small diameter bombs were also used in the wanton destruction of property in cases amounting to collective punishment. Also, we cite in our research two cases where U.S.-made JDAMs have been used to decimate entire families, two entire families. The Abu Mu'alliq family in the middle area in Deir al-Balah, and the Najjar family in Deir al-Balah also back in October. A total of 43 civilians were killed in just two attacks. Amnesty International's research did not find any evidence that there were any military targets in the area, raising doubt that the attacks were direct attacks on civilians and as such should be investigated as war crimes. And as such also, there is a high risk that by continuing to supply arms to Israel, the United States was fully aware that it is also supporting the commission of war crimes and it's complicit in the commission of war crimes.
So, Badr, has the U.S. Responded in any way to your report, which came out earlier this week?
We are still waiting for a response by the U.S. The call is clear. The call is on the U.S. to halt all arms transfer to Israel as long as Israel continues to fail to comply with international humanitarian law and international human rights law. And it's not just about the weapons that Israel is using, U.S.-made weapons. Also, Israel continues to use torture and other ill-treatment and also arbitrary detention against Palestinians, which also violates international law.
And if you could talk, Badr, about this Global Day of Action, May 2nd, today. What prompted this call? Who all is involved?
The collective includes a variety of humanitarian organizations and human rights organizations that call for an immediate ceasefire, recognizing a ceasefire is the only way to end the man-made humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, but also calling for an arms embargo in Israel and all parties to the conflict, including freezing all arms transfer and munitions to Israel. And this group came together because it recognizes that it's not just, of course, the United States. Of course, the United States is the biggest supplier of arms to Israel, but there are other countries supplying arms. There are strategic cases litigation before numerous national courts demanding that the courts demand that government stop fueling this war and fueling human rights violations.
I wanted to ask you about the number of Palestinians right now who are detained under what's called the Unlawful Combatants Law. What cases have you been working on? What are the profile of those detained, the number of those detained, if there are charges against them?
Mm-hmm. Officially, Israel acknowledges that it's currently holding 865 Palestinians from Gaza as unlawful combatants. Under unlawful combatants law, Palestinians, and they are mainly from Gaza, do not know the evidence used against them, cannot challenge the legal grounds for their arrest, and they are not charged, and they cannot face a fair trial, of course. Under the amendment to the unlawful combatants law, a person from Gaza can be detained for up to 45 days without even being issued an arrest order. They can spend for up to 75 days without seeing a judge. In many of the cases, in most of the cases we have documented, we interviewed doctors, we interviewed human rights defenders, and also interviewed journalists who said that they were told that they have a lawyer to represent them, but they never saw that lawyer. They said that they could not even ask why they are being held in jail. They did not know. Two of the doctors we interviewed spent 140 days in prison without ever knowing the charges against them, without being able to challenge the grounds based on which they are being detained. Israel never substantiated the very fact that they were taken, snatched while treating wounded in hospital, only to spend 140 days in prison and later be released without ever knowing why they were detained in the first place.
Well, earlier this week, and this is, of course, something that happened before October 7th, but just earlier this week, the U.S. has found five units of Israel's security forces responsible for human rights violations, most of them committed against Palestinians in the West Bank. The State Department said this is the first time the U.S. has come to such a conclusion about Israeli forces. And again, the violations occurred before October 7th and will not impact U.S. military aid to any of the units. If you could talk about the significance of this and whether you think this may lead to similar findings following October 7th for a far larger number of Israeli security forces units.
Of course, we think that these findings came a little bit too late in the first place. And in a sense, just implicating five military units serves to exceptionalize these five units and kind of absolve the Israeli army as a whole, the Israeli military as a whole, of its collective responsibility. Because we cannot speak about individual units in the army and not recognize that the Israeli military as a whole has been committing grave human rights violations against Palestinians. And these human rights violations for decades have been fueled by impunity, not just from the military advocate general and from the investigative systems at the Israeli army, but also by Israel's judicial system that has been incapable and unwilling to investigate these violations. So it's not just few units here and there, exactly and precisely how it's not just about one extremist or violent settlers. It's not the problem of one violent settlers, but rather the whole settlement process.
I wanted to ask you, Badr Hassan, about Gaza. You have the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, saying that the invasion of Rafah is going to take place. Can you talk about the significance of this and also talk about the famine that people in Gaza face, the opening of the Erez border? We just interviewed two people, a rabbi, American rabbi Alyssa Wise, and the Israeli-born writer Ayelet Waldman, who were arrested there as they tried to get an aid. But now Israel is saying it's open. What level of aid is getting in?
To open, first of all, as Amnesty International, we have been calling for opening all land crossings and allowing the unfettered access of aid into Gaza, as per, of course, the provisional measures ordered by the International Court of Justice. And it's good that they are finally beginning to enter, although it's not nowhere near the quantity that should be entering. But to allow meager amount of aid to enter, while on this, at the same time threatening to invade Rafah, which we know that Rafah is the main place where most humanitarian organizations are working at the moment, where more than 1.3 million Palestinians from Gaza, mostly displaced people, are staying. So invading Rafah and threatening a ground invasion in Rafah would lead to the decimation of the whole aid system in Rafah itself. So allowing humanitarian some or improving entry of humanitarian aid on the one hand, but launching a ground attack on Rafah, which would increase and complicate the humanitarian disaster in Gaza, is absolutely not going to help the humanitarian situation there, of course.
And the number of prisoners who are being held finally, Budor, I mean, on the West Bank, are since October 7th, 8,000 Palestinians have been arrested?
Yeah. More than that. At the moment, there are 9,000 Palestinians held in Israeli jails, including 3,424 administrative detainees, people held without charges or trial, which is nearly 40% of all Palestinians detainees held in Israeli jails are held without charges or trial. In addition to those detained, many of them, of course, are being detained for organizing in support of Gaza, for trying and calling for an end to the war on Gaza. But among those who were detained, and he's now just under house arrest, is Palestinian human rights lawyer Ahmed Khalifa. And he was ridiculously, he was arrested and indicted on inciting to terror because he chanted in support of Gaza and for an end to occupation. He chanted that Gaza will not surrender to the tank or to the gun. And based on that, he was indicted on charges of incitement to terrorism. He faces for up to 2 years in jail based on that law. And he is now under house arrest. He cannot work as a human rights lawyer. He faces the threat of being disbarred from Israel Lawyers Bar Association. He cannot work at the Umm al-Fahm municipality where he has been elected as a member of municipality. And if Ahmed Khalifa ends up being convicted of incitement to terrorism for chanting, this will have a chilling effect on freedom of expression. But it's also kind of gives us echoes for what's going in the USA. You know, we see these attacks by and crackdown by Israeli authorities on anyone who dares to raise their voice against the war. And similarly, we're seeing similar crackdowns in the United States against students organizing to an end to the atrocity crimes happening in Gaza.
Budra Hassan, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian writer, Amnesty International researcher on Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. We'll link to the Amnesty report titled U.S.-made weapons used by government of Israel in violation of international law and U.S. law. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We end today's show on yesterday's May Day activities in New York. Thousands of students, workers, and others rallied in Foley Square in Lower Manhattan to mark May Day.
My name is Raya Sana. I'm a Palestinian researcher and organizer with the Workers in Palestine Initiative. We have Palestinian unions have been organizing and calling for the colleagues in the labor movement and unions internationally to stop arming Israel. So since the call in October, on the 16th of October, workers internationally have galvanized and have organized in solidarity with the call. Workers in Barcelona port declare that they will be stopping arms shipments destined to Israel. Workers in Belgium and transport workers have blocked the supply of weapons to Israel. At the port of Oakland, we also saw workers here in the U.S. take concrete solidarity and action. Internationally, workers have been organizing in their workplaces and in their unions in solidarity and to heed the call. We see this also with the UAW here in the U.S. and other unions who've been calling for ceasefire and picking up the call from Palestinian workers and Palestinian unions. This year, the May Day comes at a moment where we Palestinians are subjected to an undescribable onslaught, an undescribable violence, and it's an important moment in our history to remember that workers do have the power to shape the world. Workers do have the power to influence kind of what happens not only locally, but to influence processes of colonial violence and dispossession on a bigger scale.
That was Ria Alsana, a Palestinian researcher and organizer with Workers in Palestine Initiative. And this is Julia Banan of the UAW.
As a UAW member and as the president of my local, UAW must use its political power to put teeth into their call for a ceasefire. UAW must revoke endorsements of these politicians if they want to make good on their call for a ceasefire.
Special thanks to Hannah Elias, Charina Nadura, and Messiah Rhodes. Those voices from the Foley Square rally on May Day. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astu, Joe Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. EMBARK focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at EmbarkSustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at EmbarkSustain.